Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. I am your host, Wade Wojcik, joined by Ben Robertson.
Hey, how's it going?
And with special guest, Cable Lefto.
Hey!
Welcome to the podcast. Good sir. Cable, you are a fellow filmmaker and musician here in the Twin Cities, general fellow artist.
Yes, sir.
What kind of work do you do around here?
I do a lot of little small productions, music videos, and then I play guitar and sing in bands.
Right on.
Yeah. There's not much there.
Yeah, so you were with us on this last year, 2016, 40-Hour Film Festival.
Yeah.
You helped pen the script.
Oh, yeah.
That was a fun experience.
That was really fun, yeah.
And we will talk more about that in a bit. But this episode is going to be all about management, specifically media management in our first segment, and then general team management. So previously in our episode, so this is episode 7 I didn't mention, we talked all about cameras and drones and NLEs, but we haven't really talked about how to bring all that together in a cohesive way, specifically with the crew. So I thought we could start off with media management. We're going to talk about raids, and then after that, we're going to talk about, how to deal with teams, smaller teams, bigger teams, how that all coalesces. And finally, we saw Rogue One. We're going to talk about that. You guys are going to geek out. We're all going to geek out.
Oh, yeah.
Raids, this is something that can be confusing. Sure as hell was for me when I first started looking into it. I was like, why not just get a hard drive and call it good? What the hell is this
like
raid?
Like a really
business?
Big one.
Yeah. Because like raids, I thought they were, they're the same thing, right? But it can be kind of daunting when you are first looking into it. So what I thought it'd be cool to do is talk about the different types of raids, what they're good for, and then recommend a couple different ones depending on your price point and your expertise level.
Yeah.
So Ben, what kind of raids do we got?
So there's, when you talk about the different types of raids, there's raid 0, and that goes all the way up to 6. But primarily, most commonly, you see raid 0 and raid 1. First of all, we should just talk about what raids are. Raids are raids are multiple drives, multiple hard drives that are strung together by a controller to basically make the computer believe it is one larger volume.
Yeah.
And you typically do this for 3 different reasons: for reliability, backup, redundancy, speed, and then space.
But that's the thing I forgot to mention is with, you know, HD and now 4K, especially 4K RAW, file sizes are enormous. I remember
ridiculous.
Back in, 2003 using iMovie and needing like 10 gigs for a video project back in the days of standard def video. And then I remember moving up to high def, I needed like 50 or 80 gigs. And I was like, 50 gigs of footage, this is huge. And now it's like in the terabytes. For Dawn, we had 6 terabytes of RAW footage. So that's why you need raids for reliability, redundancy, like Ben said, and space, because a lot of computers don't come with 6, 10, 12 terabytes of hard drive data built in.
No, that gets expensive. When you're working with smaller individual drives, if one fails, you can replace it for cheaper. It's just a cheap thing. It's
right.
But raids aren't necessarily either cheap either.
Nope.
It's all complex. So like depending on the type of raid that you're running, raid 0 through 6, you're typically specializing in one of those three aspects: reliability, storage, and speed. So like raid 0 has the 2 different drives, and
is it 2 or can it be more?
You can go further. I think at least in this diagram that I'm looking at visually, it shows 2. Mm-hmm. And you are writing data across both of these drives, but it's not redundant, it's not identical. You're just basically storing space over these 2 different volumes. And so when you are reading from the drives, it's reading from both simultaneously.
And treating it as one unit.
And that helps with performance in writing and reading. Mm-hmm. However, when you go to something more like RAID 1, which is having 2 drives and you're writing, they're identical to each other, there's performance is split differently. So there's the whole reading and writing. It takes longer to write to it because you have to identically write to each individual drive.
Right.
Whereas reading it is much faster.
But the plus side is, if one goes down, the other one is still there. I think with RAID 0, one of the...
if you lose a drive, everything's gone.
One drive, everything's gone. So it's not like you lose one and the other one's still there. Nope, it all goes down with the ship.
Yep.
And then there's 2, 3, and 4, which I'm not super familiar with. I was reading about 5, and 5 is somewhat of a hybrid between 0 and 1, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm. It's all gets very kind of complex.
Right. So for now, maybe, you know, no, one, zero and one are what you're...
Those are the most common that you're going to encounter.
And then did you figure out what six is, or is that just another enigma?
Six is newer, and I haven't had any experience with that.
Yeah, me either. But for Don, you know, I bought a raid to mainly just store our raw footage on, and I just made that a raid zero. I didn't have nearly enough space to make it a raid one.
Sure, but we still, as far as backup go, we still back everything up to Drive.
Yeah.
Because
Google Drive,
sorry. Because I think we spend $10 a month per user, but we have unlimited storage. Yeah. And it's on Google to make sure that all this stuff is reliable.
I think Google's pretty reliable.
You would hope so. Yeah, they have all this data and story, or all this information about all of us anyway. So
yeah, exactly. Like petabytes and whatever is above that. Yeah, so we do store a lot. We originally wanted to upload all 6 terabytes to Drive, but I don't know if we had the bandwidth for that.
There was a while where I had fiber, but that's still still tough because when you're uploading raw, Google Drive likes to think it's a whole bunch of individual images versus one large file.
Yes, because so when you shoot raw, I think with all cameras, maybe just the Blackmagic, but it records, you know, not as MOV or MP3 or MP4 files. It's frames. Mm-hmm. You have all these frames as your takes, and and that's what Ben was talking about. So yeah, so those are the different types of raids. We were looking at a couple different entry points. So for the beginner, one I was looking at was a Lacy, which Cable, you were saying earlier, you know, not totally reliable. I think you had some negative experiences with a Lacy in the past.
It could have just been me though. It's just, user error is never a thing I would count out.
Yeah. So that one has 6, 8, and 12 terabyte configurations starting at 500. So, you know, pretty reasonable. And it has USB 3.0 and Thunderbolt 2, so pretty standard. I think, yeah, for raids, Thunderbolt and USB 3 is... Well, when these were designed, the fastest at the time, now USB...
USB-C runs over Thunderbolt 3.
Right. And yeah, isn't Thunderbolt 3 the same shape?
Thunderbolt... that's the best way to put it, kind of talk about this. So like Thunderbolt 2 has that kind of rectangular shape.
Yep.
And Thunderbolt 3 is just it's just an IO port. It's a controller. It can be a couple of different shapes, but USB-C is kind of the new universal shape. It's what people are trying to push forward, that it can be a whole bunch of different things.
Right.
Isn't it roughly the shape of like an Android phone charger?
Some Androids actually do use USB-C now, but you're thinking of micro USB, and it's a relatively similar shape. So is the Lightning port.
Did you guys think it's funny that, you know, it stands for Universal Serial Bus, and yet it's not universal because there's all these different types. There's micro, there's mini, there's C.
Well, and I think that's what the effort is to finally start going towards a single universal USB-C.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, USB-A, which is what we're all used to for USB 2.0 and 3.0, that was the standard. Yeah. Like, think of all the mice and keyboards.
And I heard Apple was like pushing that when it was first being introduced. Like Apple was pushing for that hard. That USB as opposed to whatever was before that. I don't know what was before USB.
Well, it was interesting because Apple still used FireWire too. When you got a MacBook Pro, it would have FireWire 400 and
400 and 800 for a while.
And then
because it was faster than USB 2.0.
Yep.
Or FireWire 400 was relatively the same speed, but 800 was like the faster speed.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the pro IO that you went for. Because I remember when I was buying my first MacBook Pro and my first external, I wanted something as fast as possible.
Right. Yeah. I am glad that Apple keeps pushing, you know, for better speeds. So you know, growing pains aside, I am glad that that we are headed that direction. You know, obviously with, you know, getting rid of the headphone jack in spirit of, you know, moving forward, it takes courage. Yeah. And then the new MacBook Pro with only USB Type-C, well, you know, growing pains. I don't know if I would get that MacBook just because of what's available and you know, using that with all my different connections, but whatever.
Do we is there a raid out right now that's used?
Yeah, USB-C? So we were looking at the cable you brought up, the Noontech.
Yeah, Noontech, apparently they sell a raid bay. So it doesn't come with the drives, it's just a five bay.
Mm-hmm.
Like type enclosure, but it runs USB-C.
Interesting. I think it's interesting that they give you the option to choose your own drives. Like you can decide whether you want to use Western Digital or Santec or SanDisk or whatever you want.
Yeah, and that went for $250, you said, on Amazon?
Yeah, it looked like it was about $250.
Cool. Yeah, I'll have to definitely look into that, provided I one day get a machine that runs USB Type-C.
Sure.
Hopefully we all will.
Well, by the time that comes around, they'll probably be more common.
Exactly,
too,
so exactly.
Get a nice G drive.
And then on the upper end, the more professional side of the RAIDs, there's the G-Tech, which generally is a little more expensive. I remember when, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, I got a G-Tech for like $200, and that was only, I don't know, maybe 100 gigs or some crazy amount of
Did
money.
Did you feel like it was worth it, at least at the time?
Yeah, because like I had a Lacy, and what I liked about the G-Tech, and I'm sure Lacy has these drives too, but my Lacy was you had to plug into the wall. G-Tech was just plug into USB and go, or not USB, FireWire. And it's funny, I still have it, and I was trying to look into, like, look at what was on it, but I need to find a FireWire 800 to Thunderbolt to find
oh,
to,
that's
like,
great.
Look at what's in it. Or no, I think it's 400, like it's that old.
Oh wow.
Yeah, but so G drives are generally a little more expensive, but more reliable on the whole.
Yeah.
I think their hard drives are a little bit better at design too. Like they have little shock absorbers in the frames.
Yeah. The enclosures.
They are coming down in price though.
True. Yeah. Like everything, they've come down. So anyway, the G-Tech RAID, there's two different types. There's a 4-drive or 8-drive RAID. I think the one studio and the ones, I forget the name of it, but it's more professional. So it's great for 4K. It has better reliability. And it starts at 12 terabytes for $2,000 and then goes up to 80 terabytes for $9,000,
Ooh.
Which is insane. I mean, yeah, it's expensive. It is. But I mean, 80 terabytes, I mean,
that's set for life.
Yeah,
right,
you're
there.
Solid there. Maybe
you
not
hope.
Life.
And well, then, yeah. Well, then we get like some new format.
Oh, yeah.
5 years from
Once
now.
Once these red 8K cameras really take off.
Yeah, because like we say, you know, it's not entirely future proof because it is still USB 3 and Thunderbolt 2, not USB type C. So we'll see. I mean, that's the thing. I think hard drives like that in general, especially G drive, you know, they are reliable for maybe a decade or two, I hope, but the downside is the ports aren't necessarily future proof.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're all the as far as IO goes, it's all getting closer and closer towards
singularity.
Yes. I just watched Ex Machina actually, so it's been in my mind. Yeah. Anyway, we're all getting closer and closer to actual like motherboard speeds. And that's as we're getting faster and faster and faster. So you're starting to see with like USB-C external GPUs and stuff like that. Instead of it being right on the board, you have an IO port that's nearly just as fast.
Yeah.
So it's all very interesting to see how that stuff is developing further and further.
Talking about a GPU, like a graphics card that's not directly plugged into the motherboard?
Correct. Oh, yeah, that goes over USB-C.
Oh, cool. So I wonder if that would ever be applied to towers. Because right now, like, all graphics cards are just plugged right into the motherboard.
I think it kind of goes into what you're looking for. I think when you see those marketed, they are marketed towards people who want to have a high-end laptop but don't necessarily want the bulk of carrying around a laptop that has this huge GPU that's
in
it. So you have like your station, your docking station, that you come home and then you plug this in and then you edit it off of that.
And I think that was a big selling point for the new MacBook Pros, where, you know, you come home with your new MacBook Pro and you plug in USB Type-C and it does everything. It hooks up your monitors, hooks up your internet, power, all that stuff. It's crazy to think that, that's also going to be your Ethernet.
Yeah, yep. Or that Wi-Fi speeds are getting faster and faster too.
Yeah.
I mean, Apple's world is wireless in the future anyway.
It is. And you know what? For all the negative feedback I talk about with the new MacBook Pro, like, that is cool. And I did try it out, the Apple Store with the touch bar and stuff. And
I didn't care for it, actually.
You know, it's neat, but I still like, for example, having my volume and playback controls. I don't have to press a button and then get access to them. They're always right there.
Yeah.
If someone walks in and I want to hit pause, bam, done. I don't have to go, oh, hold on, button,
that's the
and then pause.
Toolbar killing the battery on that thing, too.
Is that a problem?
With the toolbar going, I think people are reporting about 3-hour battery life.
Oof.
Yeah, and Yikes. it's been a big killer on the sales for those things.
Yeah, well,
especially the fact they're $400 more than they used to
Be.
You know, I know an Apple, they'll probably do a course correction. But anyway, going back to RAIDs. So on the low end, again, the Lacy starting at $500 for the 6 terabyte, going up all the way to the G-Tech 80 terabyte for $9,000, somewhere in there.
That's insane.
But you know, there's room for most people in there. I think just starting out, a Lacy is a good bet. And it's funny, so the Lacy maxes out at 12 terabytes, and that's the starting point for the G-Tech.
But yeah, and even as like as an indie filmmaker, I'm not sure if you're always going to have like projects that huge that you're going to need 80 terabytes.
You know, we say that, but you know, 8K. You know, it's right around the corner.
It's coming in. It's coming in. So. Red just released, what, 3 cameras that have 8K?
I think it's funny that we're talking about 8K now when most people still don't have 4K TVs.
I
don't.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for them to come down in price.
Yeah. I have a 4K. I love it. But I think I'm comfortable there. Like, we haven't fully adopted 4K yet. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with 8K. So yeah, hopefully that helps you out in dealing with your storage management for your films. Coming up, we're going to talk about crew and production management. Be right back. So guys, as we mentioned before at the top of the episode, we were all in the 40-hour film festival this last year together in Minneapolis. And, you know, we had a team of seven. There were seven of us.
Yeah.
Close about that.
Me, you, David, Bryce, Kellen, Mike, and Cable. So yeah, I'm going to say seven. And, you know, it was a very quick turnaround, obviously 48 hours, and the first six or so was actually pre-production. We had a very quick pre-production timeline. So we had to be very clear and concise with our roles. Mm-hmm. So Cable, you and Kellen were the writers, and you were also acting. I was directing, and then Mike was editing, Bryce was DP, David was AD, and Ben, you were...
I kind of just filled in the gaps. I think I was a part of the original conception of what we
That's
were
right,
going to
yeah.
do.
Yep. You brought up the original pitch for the story, and then also, yeah, you're doing a lot of PA work and just in general whatever you could do to help fill in whatever needed to be done, which was also a great role to have.
Yeah, that's really important with the things like the 48.
I think really what helped us with that project versus other projects we've been a part of is a clear definition of roles. Because I think when you work on smaller teams, specifically indie stuff, I feel like it's really easy to wear a whole bunch of hats and roles get muddled. And I think with the 40-hour film festival, when you're so cut or so... time is at a premium. It's great to rely on other people and not have to always think about everything yourself.
Exactly. One of the hardest things I had to learn back, I think it was like high school or something, was as the director, you're not always wanting to hold the camera, right? But as a kid, you're like, no, I'm the director. I need to hold the camera. But it's like, no, you gotta learn the roles. And there's a very important reason for that. So yeah, like in the 48-hour film festival, like all of us couldn't be the writers.
Yeah.
Like we had to, you guys went into the room and did that. We had to figure out like fucking, where are we shooting these scenes? And like, who are we getting to act these parts and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really important just like from the very get-go of figuring out who your team is. Cause like we've been working on building a contact sheet as far as who we know and what they're skilled at. And so like when we work on projects, we define that from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And that helps move us further into production. These are things that we don't have to worry about because it's already designed and stuff.
Cable, what was it like even within writing? You know, you and Kellen, you guys were writing it together, but I'm assuming that you kind of, did you have different roles or were you kind of just all tackling it all together?
We started off with different roles. We had the basic story. We were using writer duet, so we could both write at the same time.
Which
in the
we
same
talked
script.
About, I think, in episode 3 when Kellen was
when
on.
Kellen was there.
Yeah, it was his suggestion to use it. But we started out with the like, well, here's the beats of the story. You know, if you think you've got something for a certain part, you write to that part, and then we were kind of going through and editing each other while going through until we hit that one point of like, okay, we just need to fill out this one beat and then we're done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we'll submit it to you for the final, like, is this good or.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. Yeah. Even in writing it as a pair, I've done that before on other projects and it can be challenging. One thing I would do, my friend Trav and I wrote a script together and we had two different approaches. We would either each take a different scene, write it, and then hand it to the other person, and then we would just revise the other person's scene, or we would just like kind of like go through the scene together and talk about every single line, what I had to go.
Yeah.
There. Two different approaches, but
I think part of it that helped with the whole thing is it really turned into Kellen and I trying to make each other laugh.
That's great.
It's like three in the morning. Yeah. We're both just tired as all hell.
Yeah.
And we're going, oh, we just need this thing, and writing just completely ridiculous things. The grapes line was just me going, I don't know. It'd be funny if he just yelled grapes.
Right, which was the big reveal almost.
It turned into one of the hardest things to film, I think.
Yeah. Does it work the other way around? Like, for comedy, you make each other laugh, but for drama, you make each other cry? Like,
how is that going to make you? Show the AD the budget. The prop we needed that we were required to have in the film was grapes.
So absurd.
Yeah, and I don't know if we talked about it on this podcast, but when we went to the premiere, some people had the most ridiculous uses for grapes, and some people had just a lot of people just had grapes in the name of their film. It's just like, okay, a little ran out of ideas.
That's great.
I think there was one Grapes of Wrath reference, at least one, if not more. But anyway, off tangent. And when we were on set, I think it was like we did a great job, I think, of keeping roles defined and staying professional about that. And it's fun, too, to just like, take your role and just kind of keep to that. But also, Cable, you were acting. Did you write that? Did you write your part? Did you know you were going to be that part, too?
I just knew I was going to be in it at some point.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of fell down to whatever role was not filled.
True, true. Yeah, I think, casting that came together last minute, although we got Amber to play the... was she the lead? I'm trying to remember. Yeah, they were both leads.
It was co-lead kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They shared about the same amount of screen time.
Yeah, and she was great. And I think, Kellen, who played one of the other leads... once he stepped into the role of Scrimpy, stepped into the role of Scrimpy, I think he switched gears and was like, okay, I'm not the writer. Now I'm acting. Like, now I got to take direction, do all this stuff. So it's really helpful and great when you have to switch hats, switch completely and like, okay, now I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys had to do that at all on other productions? Like, you're in this role. Okay. Now I'm switched. I think, Ben, you did that with production coordinator. And
yeah, with Don, that was a little interesting as far as how do people interact with you, like when you are either the actor, okay, I'm taking direction, but then also like, oh, look at time. We need to be moving along here. Yeah. I think David did it a lot.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, as AD. But you also did. I mean, when we weren't currently filming, after
doing call sheets and stuff.
Yeah, call sheets. Yeah, yeah. Which is really important.
Yeah, I think that it's you either find a template that really works for you or you end up making your own kind of thing. But I think it's important to at least have some sort of formulation for like how the day is going to go, when you're supposed to be there. Right. I think that it provides a certain amount of security for other people.
And just to introduce the concept for people who don't know, like, what are call sheets and why are they important?
Call sheets are basically a document full of information of what the production day is going to be like. Can you send that out to your cast and crew beforehand? Let them know what their call time is, when they should be on set, specifically where the set is.
Good info.
Always important.
It gives you general contact information for either the director or who you should be talking to specifically. Mm-hmm. And there's other good information that people kind of put on there as well, as far as what the weather is going to be like, where the closest hospital is going to be in case there's some sort of medical emergency that's needed.
Yep.
Basically, a big go-to sheet throughout the day. And it's cool too, like sometimes a lot of times they'll say, crew call is 8, cast call 9, or some later date, because obviously the cast can't get there at the beginning of the day. Wouldn't make any sense. You're not ready to roll.
Just sit around for a while.
You don't need to be here.
Yeah. Cable, if you had to switch hats during production, I guess you did a little bit too during 48 hours.
Yeah, a little bit during 48. I don't know. I guess the biggest switch I've done is I directed a music video for one of my bands recently and had to go between like running into scenes and being in it a little bit and then coming back out and being like, all right, I'm the director. Gotta do directing things.
Right.
That and like 48 Hour Film Fest was actually where I really learned the importance of having an AD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause, I would have gone and incredibly crazy on like the music video had I been doing the AD job and directorial job.
Yeah.
And watching David just about keep everything together, yeah. but mm-hmm. almost lose it just being AD.
And we're lucky. And we're lucky. David's a great AD. He's one of the best. He AD'd all of Don, and we had 15 production days, and it was just like on there every single. And actually, he kind of doubled too as a key member of the crew because he. When we shot at Cinequipped, got there super early, way before any of us.
Oh my God.
And set up like giant green screens and like crazy yeah. amounts of set pieces, which was awesome. And yeah, I think it's interesting as you move up from a small crew to a large crew, the roles get more defined and it almost becomes like a military. I had
a hierarchy kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a couple different experiences on large film crews. My first Honest Playground shot here in town. And then also when Ben and I went to New York on the set of Elementary, mm-hmm. our, Lucy Liu Sherlock knockoff.
The American one.
Yeah. That was had a crew of maybe a couple hundred. And you're like in battalions and like companies and platoons. So I was on location department. So I had like a superior and he had a superior. And it kind of like goes up a chain of command. And it's funny, like, yeah, you have clearly defined departments. Like on Honest Playground, I was on art department. And we had our platoon. Of little art, you know, minions working on the set. And then there's the PAs and they had their cool like walkie talkies and like they're all like jet black uniforms and they had their, you know, $150 a day they're working for. And it's like, you don't talk to them. They don't talk to you unless you're in direct conflict with one another. Like I remember we were 90 seconds out from rolling and way in the distance, in the background, there was like a sign that was in English and we were covering up all the English signs cause it was mm-hmm. in a fictional country. We had to cover it up with, you know, fictional language stuff. So I went to my superior and I was like, sir, there's blah, blah, blah. No, I didn't say that, but I was like, we got to cover that up. And he's like, he looked at the DP and he's like, oh man, you've got like 30 seconds. Go do it right now. I was like sprinting out there trying to, cause like, I know if I would have been out there like a second longer, like, a PA would have been like, you get your ass out there. Da, da, da. Mm-hmm. So it's really funny how like, yeah, clearly defined. And it's like, you really got to stick to your role. Ben on Corridor Digital, I'm assuming you.
Yeah. Some so of that. On a couple different days I was art and I had someone that I guess reported to, you either had like either, I think on, there was like a medium sized project. There was a couple of times where I reported to like their production coordinator, but then other days I would report to just the art director himself.
Yeah.
And it was cool. Like we would work there together and then there would be opportunities where he would let me kind of create something specifically that I can own. And then he can like review it and work with me too. So specifically it's kind of like an apprenticeship kind of thing. Like, here's what I do. Let me teach you kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Which was great. And then on other days I was AC as well, mm-hmm. and getting to work directly with Nico and stuff, that was great too as far as understanding their thought process. But it's all still very defined, but in a way that is, at least working with them, not so much regimenty, because the way that they shoot, I think that was even one of their larger shoots as well, mm-hmm. they're used to kind of guerrilla stuff,
yeah,
and so they're gonna have to work towards with something with more form, but they're still kind of colloquial enough where it's like, I'm going to work with you on this.
They definitely have, that hybrid mindset. And mm-hmm. I noticed that too. The days that I worked with them, I was AC.
You got to be camera. Or yeah. You got to shoot some
shots. So I trailed Sam and Nico a lot. Like I was right behind them. And you were on art that day, mm-hmm. and it was funny, yeah, because like we didn't talk at all.
No,
because we had just had our completely different jobs.
It was weird, like yeah, normally you and I would like be talking on set on other stuff or whatever. Like we're all like buddy and friends or whatever. That day, I feel like I saw you like maybe like twice.
Yeah, no, we just had our roles, we had our departments. We were like, nope, different jobs. Mm-hmm. We got to be on point like the entire time.
And that shoot was an crazy shoot because that was the day that we were in St. Paul. They closed down the street, and there was mm-hmm. all the action stuff.
Yeah.
Yep. So many different working angles that were going on there. It was incredible. Like all the stunts.
Was
and everything.
That the one for the division?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because when the heroes are first entering that city block at the beginning of the scene, they like, my car, my crappy orange Cavalier is right front center. Mm-hmm. As they're, I'm like, yep, that looks like it's been through an apocalypse.
Oh, and my new car is in there too.
Yeah, but they were like shooting up your car too with their like dust filled paintballs or whatever they were.
It was cool. It was a really cool effect, and I think it really actually worked for them on screen.
Yeah, they did a lot of awesome special effects, explosions, you know, stunt people being thrown. Windows being blown off.
I got to drive that taxi too.
Yeah, so
it was a shit taxi.
Yeah, so what they're doing, they rigged up a taxi. I know we're going off tangent, but they rigged up a taxi. This would have been the special effects department, and they were like, the special effects guy was like, yeah, you know, it's gonna like spider crack or spider web crack or whatever.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like, I'm maybe 10 feet away from it, right behind Sam, who's filming with the red, and action, and they're pushing the taxi, and the effect is they were supposed to be like shooting the windows. Boom, boom, the windows completely explode. Glass shatters all over me and Sam. And it's like, Jesus Christ. It's like, did you get it? Good. Check the camera. No, that ended up looking really cool. And what's funny, too, is David and I were prepping the cameras during that shoot. And our table was right next to the special effects department, specifically the people who were rigging up the squibs, the blood squibs.
Yeah.
And we butted heads a little bit because like we needed I think paper towels for something to clean the cameras, and they were using them, and they were like, nope, you can't use these. I'm like, come on, we're supposed to be on the same team. It's like, nope, when you're in your team, your regiment, like you have your job and that's all you care about.
So then how does that translate to post then, as far as, because you still have departments like that, right?
Yeah. Well, again, it scales with the level of crew you have. Mm-hmm. So right now David and I and Lee, to some extent, doing post on Don. We, David and I share a lot of files. And I mean, Premiere and like Adobe in general, you know, has its cloud service. And then Final Cut has its own built-in way you're supposed to share files. We don't have like shared area networks. We don't have, you know, network drives we're pulling from. So what we do is Google Drive, which is, you know, pretty good. So, you know, we use Google Drive to store files natively on our machines, but then, you know, update them through their cloud service, specifically with After Effects shots. So what we'll do is we'll render out, you know, the raw shots we need and then throw those on Drive. So we access those together, and then the project itself is on Drive. So anytime we open it up, you know, we don't have to relink any files. It's all there, and it's the same thing the other person opened up. We obviously can't do that with the full film because that would be
huge,
way too big to put. Well, we could put it on Drive, but it would just be, it'd be a mess. So instead we have these SanDisk 2 terabyte drives that we each have, and they're clones of each other. After enough time passes that maybe my drive has changed enough, then I'll just like reclone it on his. But for the most part that works out. And so for the most of the post work we share is on Google Drive. We again have all the source files on there, so we don't have to do any relinking, and that works pretty well for us. Then we just have to like go on Slack and say, hey, I'm in S11, don't go in there,
yeah,
and fuck everything up. But yeah, that's our process for that. But yeah, hopefully that helps clear up some questions about management, team management, media management. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Rogue One and franchise management. Ben is rubbing his hands. He can't wait to dive into Rogue One.
I'm ready to go.
Yeah. I already feel an argument starting.
I've been looking for it. I've been looking for a discussion for probably about like ever since I saw the movie. Because I couldn't talk about it because Wade hadn't seen it yet.
And now I have. And I know it's like the last couple months we've covered the biggest and best blockbusters, but we'll go back to the smaller films eventually. For now, it's impossible not to talk about Rogue One. Everyone's talking about it. And I will say, I did enjoy the film. However, I feel like I'm going to be the biggest downer here among the bunch. Not to say that I didn't like the film. But anyway, first impressions, Ben.
I didn't like the movie.
Ah, get the hell out of here.
Yeah. All right. See, I told you. I feel the arguments.
Yeah. So I think my first impression from the movie, and it might have just been the people that I was surrounded by, because there was a guy who chose the loudest way to eat his popcorn. But I remember walking out of The Force Awakens and wanting to see the movie again right away. And I remember leaving Rogue One and like, I don't want to see this movie again.
I'm shocked. Yeah. I honestly thought you were going to rave about this film.
No.
Well, maybe I'm not going to be the most down person about it then.
Great. Cool. Cable, what do you got?
So preface, I love Star Wars. Everything about it.
Good.
Like, well, yeah. And it's one of those movies where even if it does wrong, or like that franchise, if it does wrong, I'll still love it. Mm-hmm. I'll recognize the wrong. I don't think they did really any wrong in Rogue One. I loved it. Yeah,
snap.
See? I
gearing up. Let's go.
I loved it. I did walk out of the theater wanting to see it again.
That's
and then I did.
I'm glad we can. Okay, so maybe I'm in quite literally in the middle of you guys right now, but also in the discussion. I enjoyed the film. I thought it was good. I had a good time watching it. However, I didn't like it as much as Force Awakens, and I do have my gripes about it, which we'll get into. But most importantly, Ben, I want to hear what's going on in your mind about this film.
I think I want to say, I think the third act was good. I think the fight, the battle, getting the Death Star plans and getting out, I think that was really, really well paced. And I think for the most part that was done well. I think there were a couple of other things in the movie that really bothered me. The first being is having the little lower thirds talking about which planet they're at or which location they're at.
Yeah.
Bothered the shit out of me.
Man, we were just lasering into one very specific complaint.
Yeah, I have a couple of different complaints, but that one.
They're all laser pointed though.
I get your point, but I want to know, like, why didn't you want to see this again when you walked out of the theater?
I think there were. My favorite movies are the ones that make me don't want to analyze the movie. I don't analyze the movie. If I can't analyze the movie because I'm enjoying it so well and I'm loving it, I think it's done a great job. Mm-hmm. But this movie, I had to. Like, I just was. There were a lot of points where they were griping with me that I couldn't get past.
Okay.
Well, that probably partially comes from it's the first Star Wars movie outside of the Skywalker saga. Sure. So you're going to go into it wanting to analyze it because it's a different story.
So I didn't go into it wanting to analyze it. And I was actually really excited about this movie. And maybe that was my issue, is that I had failed expectations. Because I was excited that it was going to be a grittier Star Wars movie.
It was gritty, though.
It was, yeah. There was some good gritty parts. I didn't think the music always fit with the grittiness. I think the music was still sometimes a little too Star Wars-y.
On that note, do you remember any specific themes? Because I don't. And that's weird for a Star Wars movie.
This was the first Star Wars movie that was not composed by John Williams.
Okay. And they did take a lot of John Williams themes and then twist them, which is why I think it's hard to remember. Because like when they had forgotten the opening crawl, they took that you know, main Star Wars theme that you recognize, and it was twisted just in a way that was like original, but you could still recognize it.
Which I think speaks a lot to the film itself. I feel like they did that. Just took everything we already knew and just kind of twisted it a little bit.
I liked the fact that it was a different Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate that, and I want that to continue. I just think there were a couple of different things, specific things that bothered me.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Cable, why did you want to see it again walking out?
It really, really honestly, it was mostly because it brought me back to that feeling of when I was like 4 years old, mm-hmm. and my parents showed me Star Wars for the first time, and it was just so cool and exciting, and spent the next, you know, 10 years watching those movies, mm-hmm. you know, almost like weekly. At one point, my parents were getting frustrated when I was real young because I literally every day I would say, nope, I don't want to do this thing. I want to watch Star Wars.
That's great.
I'm afraid to play the, because like I have the original VHSs. I'm afraid to play them because I watched them so many times as a kid.
You don't want
to
ruin them.
Yeah, they might be ruined. I kind of want to save them for that experience with my children.
Sure. Yeah, especially if they're not the special edition ones.
Yeah, no, they are the like first printing of the VHSs. Yep, so it's like I'm terrified.
That's great.
But like, just like Force Awakens, I left the theater with that feeling of like, and I think part of it came in with the interesting use of CGI, mm-hmm. to recreate characters that I recognized, which there were problems in that. I see the look on your face. Yeah. We can get into that next. But like when just that one shot at the end, the 30 seconds where you get to see Leia, and you just get that one line of like the leading you into 10 minutes later, mm-hmm. being the beginning of, mm-hmm. A New Hope. Mm-hmm. I was just so excited that I had to go home and watch A New Hope.
Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
I just wanted to, like, I felt great about recapturing that feeling.
Yeah. I'll say for me, you know, growing up, Star Wars was one of my favorite things. It inspired my love of like space and sci-fi and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I was a huge fanboy as a kid. I think I am now with this movie officially out of fanboydom. It's just, it doesn't do it for me anymore. The lasers, the Force, TIE fighters, X-Wings, it just doesn't do it for me anymore.
Interesting.
And I think it did it for a lot of people with this movie.
Yeah.
But the fan service had, if anything, a negative effect on me in this film. I didn't like any of the fan service. I thought it was, in a lot of ways, forced, like, R2-D2 and C-3PO, that was forced.
Yeah, that felt a little shoehorned.
There was too much Darth Vader. The Darth Vader thing, at the end, while really cool, like, I don't like things in Star Wars because they look cool. I like, mm-hmm. them because they have emotional and meaningful impact from a character narrative perspective. when I see blogs like, this is the most badass Vader we've ever seen, and this changes everything with how we look at A New Hope, it's like, I don't care about Vader looking and being badass. I don't care that there were really cool AT-ATs and they had to fight. Star Wars, for sake of being and looking badass, to me, it doesn't do it for me. It doesn't bring you there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys like the fan service in this one or not, but
no, I had issue with one specifically, the R2-D2 and 3CPO. The two Tatooine patrons, the one that's like, oh, I'm wanted on 12 different systems.
Damn that.
Yeah. You didn't need that either.
Yeah, they didn't either. I'll admit I laughed at that because I was like, I know who that
is. But it didn't help. Within the context of the film, yeah, why not? Just throw everything in. Get the Millennium Falcon in there too. Why not? We've already done it so much. No.
Okay, good.
But I'm just, but like, why? You know, they might as well. I mean, it's fan service the movie. Like with Grand Marth Tarkin, is that his name?
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Grand Moff Tarkin. There we go. Mr. He fell down the uncanny valley.
Yeah, which I had issue with that.
I will
that.
Say, they introduced him in a really cool way, where it was the reflection of the window, and I was like, oh, cool, they're just going to like be mysterious and not really show him.
Which I would have preferred.
Lots and lots of close-ups. Yeah. Here we go.
I would have preferred that. Although, I did find it interesting how they did a lot of that CGI. I don't know if you guys saw, they released a small video.
No.
And I only saw part of it because I saw the little like preview of the video on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
They had this device that the actor, whose name I can't remember.
Yeah, but he's like the evil minister in Harry Potter.
Yeah. Yeah, he already looks a lot like Peter Cushing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they had him wear this device that covered his mouth, essentially.
Interesting.
And then they molded his face around and built the mouth over this device.
Okay.
Which was where my problem with the CGI came in. I couldn't figure out why, like, I liked it, but it looked a little weird. And one of my friends who I saw the movie with pointed out, as you would go through the scene and everything would look fine and you'd start to forget it's a CGI character, right until it seemed like the last moment when something in the mouth looked wrong. Hmm. Like the mouth moved in a way a human mouth wouldn't necessarily move.
Yeah.
But it's really subtle.
I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I was still trying to figure out why, because I knew they'd done the facial mapping over. And it turns out they were just mapping like a mouth that they built.
Interesting.
Okay.
Over this device. And I think the device was partially so that I'm assuming it's probably some sort of voice recorder.
Hmm.
Yeah,
because they morph the actual actors' voices too.
Right, right. I'm curious. I kind of want to watch that now and figure out what they did, because that sounds really cool. But you know, I watched Red Letter Media's review of this film, and I'm kind of in line.
Seen it yet.
It's really good. I think you'd enjoy it. They are very critical of the film, and I think they make some good points. One thing that made me chuckle was Mike said that this is like a Star Wars fan film, essentially.
Yep.
He's like, it's the best fan film I've ever seen, but I don't think they got Star Wars quite right, which is interesting. Like, okay, so they used old footage from A New Hope with the X-Wing pilots.
They used unused footage.
Yeah, I think it actually looked really good. I thought that was good.
Didn't like that.
No,
it was cool, but the fact that they used it to me screams,
I will agree with you there. I think as far as bringing in like using CGI to bring in stuff from like A New Hope, I thought that was the one believable part that I thought, as far as like considering CG Leia and CG Tarkin.
Yeah.
I thought that stuff probably looked the best.
Didn't it like take you out though? Because to me, I was just like, I know that
it did
when
take
he says
me out of the story.
When he says Red 5, where are you going? I know he's talking about Luke. Like, I know he's not talking like that fucking guy who dies, who's the old Red 5. It's like, guys, come on.
Well, and so there was a massive recut of this movie, right?
Yeah.
Massive reshoots. Yep.
Yeah. And you'll see it in the old trailers.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Jin, and we haven't even talked about Jin yet, when she's walking along the catwalk to move the satellite, a TIE fighter like rises up to meet her. That shot's not in it. And then there's a shot that someone pointed out with her and the captain running through the final battle on the ground, and she's got the hard drive. So implying there was some other form of escape initially planned, which it's like, okay, well, I wonder what that was. And did they change it to kill everyone in the end? I don't know.
So what I had heard was that her character in the initial draft, in the initial edit, was too dark, was too gritty. And I think Disney wanted it to be a more likable character.
More hopeful?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Oh, yeah. Perhaps built on hope?
Yeah. Oh. Man, no shit.
And so I think that they re-edited the story. Because when you look at it, in the trailers, there's a scene or there's a line that from Forrest Whitaker that says like something like be careful of who you become.
Yeah, like yeah. Well, what I heard from that was, yeah, like he was a big, you know, rebellion fighter and then got captured and tortured, whatever. So that's why he's so like broken, wounded, yeah. Dotted on. Kind of like
two different robot legs.
Yeah, like disillusioned as a man. What do you guys think of the moment when the whole like city's being destroyed and the shockwave's coming and he's like, no, go, I'm done riding. And it's just like, why?
Yeah.
You could just gop on the ship.
It seemed like the writer's like, oh, we don't have anything more for
him. Let's just write
him
out of the script.
Yeah.
Because like up till that point, he seemed like a very like, you know, there's all this security around him and he was very like,
it seemed like there was substance
protective.
To him.
Yeah.
And honestly, when I think about it now, I feel like you could take him out of the movie and the movie would still happen.
Yeah. He was totally a character that was thrown in because he's in Star Wars, The Clone Wars a little bit, the TV series.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And he's also, he's appeared on Star Wars Rebels, the TV series, and he's coming back again. I feel like that was kind of their way to shoehorn in, because I believe they also have talked about Galen Erso in either of the TV shows and whatnot. So it was kind of the pulling this all together. Yeah.
So I'm gonna touch on that real quick, because Star Wars is owned by Disney.
Yep.
What is also owned by Disney?
Marvel.
Holy shit.
Yep.
Marvel has everything that just like comes, everything has to sync, and you have to have that fan service that makes How many Marvel movies is there like a scene at the end of the credits where they have one superhero interacting with another superhero?
You're saying everything comes together. It does and it doesn't.
It's not perfectly.
The TV universe is also part of that, and they can't sync that. They're trying so hard, and the best they can do is say, oh yeah, New York was destroyed that one time.
Yeah.
You know what? Just real quick tangent. I wonder, what the Infinity Wars are going to be like. You're taking all these different tones and they're bringing them together.
That's a whole hour long podcast.
Yeah.
I could do
myself. Well, we'll bring that up some other time. But, what do you guys think of the main character, Jin?
Jin?
Starting with the most cynical on my left.
You know, I think for the most part, I liked her character, but I think there were some issues that I had with her moments of emotional outburst. I felt like some of them felt a little forced. Like there was a moment where she sees the hologram with her dad, and I kind of believed that moment.
Yeah, I believe that
too. But the scene where she's trying to get everybody
she's trying to give her speech.
Yeah, that felt awful forced, and I didn't really believe that.
I felt like they didn't give in that. There wasn't enough attached to it to give emotional weight. Like she was really cautious of the rebellion, and then like the rebellion blows up her dad.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden she's like super into the rebellion, and it's like, wait.
I think there was potential for her character. I just felt like most of the time she was just kind of like sassy for the sake of being, or not sassy, but like, I don't know, just contrite for the sake of being contrite.
It probably comes in partially because, and this is one thing that I found, I had a lot of problem with how people receive the movie, not necessarily the movie itself. They were very clearly trying to not make her seem as much of a Mary Sue character, because people were crying Mary Sue over Rey in Force Awakens. Yeah. Like, crazy. No one's doing that here, which is kind of bothersome to me, because she's very clearly not a Mary Sue character. They give you the whole story, just like Rey, they give you why she is able to do the things she does and all that. But they just kind of like shoehorned a lot of things to make her not seem so Mary Sue for Jin.
Because I think the issue was that they had so many other characters and so many other things that are going on. You have to touch on all of them versus just having these two characters, and you can focus on just them and their interactions and their place in the world. That extends to the planets too. That's another part. But
also, it's a small point, but they had another moment in this film that mirrored Force Awakens, where it was during the stormtrooper fight, the first one in the city, and Jin's like fighting a bunch of guys, and the captain's like, "I'll come save you," and then he's about to shoot, and then she defeats them, and he's like, "Oh, okay,
yeah."
Like it's like the same moment, from Force Awakens.
That is the same moment, yeah.
But yeah, you know, I agree, Ben, with the hope thing. Was a little forced, and I forgot about the thing where the rebels kill her dad.
Yeah,
and she's just like, "Oh no, that's fine."
Yeah, she's like super angry about it, and then just immediately is like, but it's really the Empire's fault.
Like, I'd be,
you're like, no, but the rebels blew up your, they dropped a bomb on your dad.
Yeah, I would be pissed at both the Empire and rebels. Like, you two just like brought my family in the middle of this war and just fucked everything up.
She would have almost had to have been like, if they probably killed Saw, because that would have been that moment where she would have been like, I get why Saw does this, and then gone and
anything, she should have been more of a character like him, like just kind of his own like freedom fighter off on doing his own thing.
Yep.
That's what I got the feeling of from the trailers.
Yeah.
Right. The best thing I liked about this film, I would say, is the explanation for why the weakness in the Death Star is there.
Yes.
I think is a well-written part of the film.
Well, and that's that thing that people, you know, for years have been speculating, like, they couldn't have been
joking about.
Yeah, like, it couldn't have just been the thing. Like, they needed that exhaust port. It's probably
the Death
like,
Star was an inside job.
Yeah.
Oh, my God! What?
Oh, someone needs to start a conspiracy blog.
Oh, yeah. Jet fuel can't melt Death Star.
Yeah, there's no way a 2 meter wide exhaust port can take down a place.
So, what did you think about the use of the actors, though, as far as like the range of Mads Mikkelsen and then Donnie Yen and all these other names?
I mean, I love Donnie Yen, so whatever he does is fine.
I do too. But no, consistently saying the Force is with me, or I'm one of the Force, and the Force is with me.
I thought it brought up an interesting thing where they're talking about like how they've always talked about how everyone is connected to the Force, but it was really interesting to bring in a character who is not a Jedi, but still has a clear
like
connection
Maz.
To the Force. Yeah, like Maz, where he's like Force sensitive. He can manipulate it, but not in the way like a Jedi can. Like, he was able to tell Jin was there because he could feel the Kaber crystal around her neck.
Yeah. Or he can, you know, pull out a blaster and shoot a TIE fighter blind and have it crash into something else perfectly.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I was expecting him to do something with that crystal. Like, maybe, like, take the crystal at some point around her neck, like the Nelkus, and, like, maybe put it into his staff and make a lightsaber. I don't know.
Just I'm kind of glad they didn't do something like that.
Yeah, I know.
Because it brought in a lot of that.
It would have been a cliche.
Yeah, I think...
I wanted to see him fight Darth Vader.
Yeah, that would have been cool. That would have been great.
At this point, why not? Just throw it all in.
Yeah. But I thought it was interesting how they show the Force as a religion.
Yeah.
Because in The New Hope, the one dude talks about one of the Imperials talks to Lord Vader, the one who gets choked. Mm-hmm. And he's like, your old false religion or whatever like that.
Yeah.
And that line, I think, makes a little bit more sense with the way that they portrayed the Force in this movie.
Well, cool. And with Donnie Yen praying the whole time, doing the I am one with the Force is with me, or whatever. It was almost like the Lord's Prayer or something.
Sure.
And it was really interesting. And it brought in that whole thing where people talk about how the Force, like, you have a destiny, the Force is with you, which also makes sense. And it did make all of a sudden a lot of sense why, like, stormtroopers miss throughout all the movies.
My God. No, their accuracy in this film were so bad.
Yeah, but the whole idea, and this is where we really start to hit my nerddom for Star Wars, is that the Force will protect you if you have, like, a certain goal, and that's what he's praying.
The Force is another word for screenwriter armor.
Plot armor.
There we go, no doubt. I will say one thing maybe my favorite part of this film, I think it has some of my favorite shots in Star Wars.
Yeah.
My favorite, and it was too quick. It should have been a little longer. It's when the fleet is warping in for the final battle, that it's like a shot where the camera's like on an X-wing wing and it comes out of hyperspace and it's in the battle. That shot is so cool. I also love the shots from the Death Star point of view of destroying part of the planet. I think it's really clever that it wasn't fully capable to destroy a planet. It could destroy parts of a planet. I think that was also really fun to see.
It was also really interesting to see the actual destruction of the planet, whereas in the early movies you only you just saw the planet explode.
It just goes in a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then to actually see, like, oh, it hits and now everything's erupting. Mm-hmm. Like, it was that was really cool.
On the weakest side, I would say I don't think this is a movie that needed to be made. You know what I mean? Like, it's cool that it shed some light on, I guess now we kind of know what happened in the opening crawl of A New Hope, but it's like in Harry Potter, you know, when Voldemort was figured out where Harry Potter, the baby, lived and he went to kill him. But there was one guy who like stood in his way. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole book about that encounter. It's like, I don't care. He went and tried to kill and failed. That's all we need to know.
Sure.
Yeah. I think it was an interesting jumping off point for the franchise, though, because they want to do that. They want to do
this first Star Wars movie that wasn't an episode.
Yeah. They wanted because from the chatter I've heard, what I understand is happening is both with Star Wars and Marvel, Marvel's gonna do like 3 movies a year, and Star Wars wants to do 1 movie a year until people stop buying
tickets. Oh my god, that's gonna be the worst.
yeah, like I love superheroes and Star Wars and all that, but I guarantee at some point I'm just gonna be like, I don't care.
I would like to see more Star Wars in different mediums. I think when we talk about how stories are done in cinema, I see a lot of it as far as deep stories. I feel like a lot of more of that's happening in television.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of like bigger name actors from cinema that would be maybe about like 10 years ago that did like a lot of really great work. They're not necessarily making movies anymore. They're doing
episodic movie TV shows.
Yeah, so like Anthony Hopkins in Westworld. Like performance was amazing, and that's where he is.
Yep.
Is in television.
Hmm. Yeah,
so it'd be cool to see Star Wars in that live action versus cartoon.
Yeah. I look at again bringing it back to more nerd things. Look at Marvel. I think the Netflix stuff, I love the movies. They're great. Yeah. But I think the Netflix stuff is my absolute favorite thing mm-hmm. they've done, because it's a 14-hour story. They have time to build the characters.
Yeah.
I've never cared about a villain in any of those, but they dedicate an episode to the villain. You see why he's bad.
Sure.
Maybe he doesn't necessarily see it as being bad. Da, da, da. I want to see them do something like that with Star Wars.
Yeah.
It would be interesting, I think, for sure.
I mean, they do have like the Rebels and
yeah, but
like
I mean
that,
like
right?
Something gritty on like Netflix. Like
Gritty on Netflix.
That's where you have to do it. Yeah. Netflix, Hulu's still on the lighthearted side.
Yeah.
I think my issue is that with these movies, they're relying so much on fan service.
They are.
The member berries. And
eventually that well will dry up. It has with me, even though I still
I think
see
people are
going
to get bitter about it. People are already bitter about it.
Yeah.
It seems just like milking it for money is what it feels like. And I'm interested to see what episode 8 is going to be like, because I understood all of like the fan service and stuff in episode 7, because it's trying to reignite the fan base for Star Wars. Yeah,
which they did.
I think they did it very well. Yeah. But I with Rogue One, I don't like if this is what we're going to see. I'm not happy.
Get ready for the Han Solo movie.
I got incredibly more ready for it when they announced Donald Glover.
Oh yeah.
Cause
as Lando Calrissian.
Yeah. He actually looks like Billy Dee Williams when
he was younger.
Yeah.
So. You know what, at this point though, I like the idea of the episode 8 and 9, cause at least they're going forward now and not relying so much on the past. Mm-hmm. Like I love the original Star Wars trilogy so much, but I don't need it expanded. I don't need these side going back more prequels. Let's move forward. Let's move into the future. That's all I want. That's all I'm asking for.
And from what I understand, that 8 and 9 are supposed to be like completely different movies. Like you haven't seen this kind of Star Wars movie.
All right.
Before.
Well, we'll look forward to that then.
Yeah.
Cool. But yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of really good points brought up. Cable, I mean, you were very fair in your discussion. I don't think you brought up too many points that Ben could lash out and disagree with, even though he was doing his thing over there.
I was holding it in, the hatred.
How many more times are you going to see it?
How many times have you seen it already?
I've only seen it twice.
Okay, same here.
But I wouldn't be surprised if I go at least one more time.
Sure, sure.
I saw Force Awakens 5 or 6 times. So
wow.
I still would like to see it at the Zoo's IMAX.
If
it's still there.
I don't know if it is, but Star Wars movies in the Zoo IMAX is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
Yeah,
I think definitely. I just need to see it once more where I don't have to be mad at the audience.
Yeah, I saw it once. I might see it again. We'll see. I did see Force Awakens 3 times. I think 2 was good. The first time I saw it was a regular screen. You need IMAX just for the sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The sound was too quiet the first time I saw
it. Yep. You see it at AMC in Roseville, because that's where...
Yeah, it might have been.
It just wasn't loud enough.
Right, right. But, you know, I just, moving forward and talking about management again, franchise management, I just, like, so the point you brought up, Cable, that they're going to keep releasing these films until no one buys them. I believe that. I really hope that they do their best to not rely on the past so much and just keep trying to grow as a franchise.
I have faith in this. At the moment, I have faith in their Star Wars idea. I think Disney's been doing a really good job with Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
In reinventing the movies every few movies so you don't quite fatigue as hard.
I think they have too. And, you know, their tone is different in a good way. So, for example, like Winter Soldier was like kind of like a Cold War
thriller.
Espionage. And then
they were like, oh, yeah, also we need superheroes in this.
And then, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy is just like an off-the-wall, fun adventure movie. Like, they have good tone differences that I think has a different draw. And I like that a lot. We'll see how those tones coalesce when they have to come together eventually.
Yeah.
But Star Wars, I do hope that they... Well, I don't know. That's tough, man. Because Star Wars is different. It's a different animal. And it's really hard. Because people either want... They want... kind of the same, kind of different, and a very fine mix of those two things.
Yeah, I when we look at how Star Wars is done, when it's been led by like one person deciding like this is the way it's gonna be, kind of fell in this flat. And I hope I hope Disney allows people to kind of do what they want with Star Wars. And yeah, I don't know.
Well, we'll
I don't have faith. I have hope.
Oh, God. Oh, by the way,
bringing it back.
I just wish they would have just held on the first shot of Leia where they just show her from behind and not her face.
Yes.
I think that would have been more effective. I didn't need to see her face.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I was mad. I think I threw up my arms.
I thought it was weird that she would have been at the battle. Like, why did
and
she
not
need
freaking
to,
out? You know, just like chilling there, standing still, fine, whatever.
Like, she, I get why they did it to make sense for the film itself, but like that ship, was that the one that rammed the Star Destroyer?
No.
Okay.
That ship that she was on is the, you know, the ship from the beginning.
Right, but I'm just wondering why that ship was like attached to the Star Destroyer during the film. Because remember, they were like, launch, and then they detached from the Star Destroyer.
No, they didn't detach from the Star Destroyer. They detached from one of the other Mon Calamari ships.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Oh, because like Vader and a bunch of stormtroopers were on that ship
because they boarded.
Yeah, they took Vader's destroyer and boarded it, and then
I missed that.
Going to those cool shots, I know they really didn't need that epic Vader scene at the end, but it was really cool to see that dark, dark cloudy hallway, and then the lightsaber come up, and you can just see him. That was a really cool
shot. I think
it
was cool to see everybody's terror.
Yeah.
That was cool. But the whole, like, Darth Vader doing a pun in his evil fortress of evil.
Yep, he was a pun. You know what? Okay, I'm so glad I forgot to bring that up. God damn it, that pun. Be careful not to choke on your aspirations, director. You know what that reminded me of? It reminded me of the characterization of Darth Vader from Epic Rap Battles of History. Right? Because, like, I have expected him to say, suck on D's. Stormtrooper comes in. D's what, sir? D's robot nuts. Like,
I think,
why not at that point? Just bring it all out.
I think my line that I hated was as they're leaving Yavin.
Yeah.
And they're still in the ship. It's like, oh, you can't leave. What's your designation? And like dude just like looks back at Jin. Like, what? Like, I don't know. You say something. Rogue One.
Movie title.
Roll credits.
Yeah. You get that scene from Family Guy with Peter going, he said the name!
Ah! Oh, shit. Or like, that's the one where Superman's like, how am I going to become Superman? Part 4. Da, da, da. Like,
yeah, he said it.
Yeah. We went a little long today, but I think there was a lot to unpack with this film. Mm-hmm. We'd all recommend it, seeing it, right?
It's a Star Wars movie. Sure, go see it.
Oh, God. Give him your money. Give him your $16 for a matinee or whatever it is these days. Anyway, a lot to like, but you know, I hope that they try. Oh God, there it is. The word hope. I implore Disney and the production team behind Star Wars to just try and focus more on story and characters and less on weird CGI and fan service.
Yeah.
Because ultimately there are some stories that, and some things I don't think we need to see. Yoda with a lightsaber was one of them. We didn't need to see that.
Yep.
But anyway, I'm still excited. We'll see if the new Han Solo prequel looks good. But episode eight coming out this year. Is it this year?
We haven't seen any. Yes, December.
We haven't seen any trailers, but...
yeah, no, they said they're probably going to hold off till spring.
That makes sense. You don't want to overlap those trailers with Rogue One too much.
I won't. Yeah. Won't see those. I won't.
That's right. You didn't see any trailers for episode seven.
I didn't. I saw one trailer for Rogue One because I knew what the story was going to be, obviously.
Sure.
But okay. Episode eight, I'm staying away from.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing those. Cable, thanks for dropping by for this episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ben. And as always, to the audience, thank you for listening to this episode of the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. We will be back next time with a lot more great stuff to talk about. See you then.